was your rest last night? There's lots of things that can disturb rest, and lots of times we don't have things like the 4th of July that interrupts our rest. So if you heard it or not, lots of popping, lots of things going off. But, you know, there's other things. It could be maybe the room is too hot, maybe the room is too cold. Maybe there's someone in another room snoring or an animal moving around. You know, whatever it could be, things around us can disturb our rest. And we get up, and what's the one thing we want when we haven't had good rest?
More rest.
So maybe what will happen after you leave here, you go and have something to eat, and all of a sudden your body will say, it's time for rest. It's the Lord's day. Why not rest in the Lord? Rest physically and rest emotionally, knowing that the God of heaven and earth is in control of all things. Even when you're sitting here thinking, I wish I could control more things. And that's our challenge. That's the thing that brings a lot of unrest in our lives. One of the things that God tells us is, don't harden your heart, because I'm there, I'm with you. But oftentimes when we don't find the rest or get the rest, and we question God about the rest, our hearts can become hard towards God. Our hearts can start to distrust. And think, God, if you're not going to do it, then I'll do it. I'll do it my way. If you're not going to join me, I'll go on my way. But one of the things God wants is, I don't want you to harden your heart. I want you to have a soft heart that trusts in me. And don't be surprised that I want you to be a part of my life. And isn't it interesting, you know, you hear that just that little snippet in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus tells us, come to me, all of you who are weary. Our life is filled with weariness. He says, I've got the answer. And when we're thinking about the Torah and the Israelite walk out of captivity towards rest, the challenge is, will I trust God? He wants us to join in that rest. That's why he created us, to be in his presence in a rest. But the interesting thing about this weariness is that we struggle with accepting how God is working things out, and it causes unrest within us. And it happened with the Israelites too, when they could not foresee, what is God trying to do here? I feel the same challenge in my own soul. And it becomes a wrestling match, kind of like Jacob, between me and God. And he says, take my yoke upon you. The interesting thing about it is when we think about rest, we're not thinking about putting on a yoke. Because yoke is telling us, oh, there's work to be done. Well, that doesn't sound very restful. But isn't it fun when you do a work project with other people and you're working together and you're laughing together and things get done together? And at the end of the day, you look at it, and you look at it, pat each other on the back, and say, look what we did together. But see, we're good Americans. We don't like togetherness so much. We like individuality, independence from one another. I want to do a project and let people see what I've done so I can get the glory, as opposed to saying, let's join together and get something done. It doesn't matter who gets the glory, because all glory belongs to God anyway. So God wants us to join him in his work. And it's kind of like this. Could you imagine? Now, there's one person in this picture that's probably getting actual work done. There's actually probably someone getting the grass cut. And maybe this person who's mowing the lawn is thinking, man, I don't want to mow the lawn again. Have you had that going through your mind so far this summer? Again, I've got to mow the lawn. It keeps growing and growing. Well, don't plant grass. Because it does. It keeps growing. Plant something that won't keep growing. oh, this is a burden. But the little on the side said, we're going to mow the grass? I get to be alongside you mow the grass? This is great. And they want to be alongside the one mowing the grass, and they're enjoying thinking that they're mowing the grass and can't wait until they can mow the grass, until they get to the age when they mow the grass. And all of a sudden, they don't want to mow the grass anymore. Because it is a burden now. And isn't it interesting, the change in the mindset, that if I can do that with you, I think I'm grown up. But as soon as it becomes in our mind work, we resist it. We want it. Because that doesn't bring you rest. I'm doing it for you. Not for me, because I don't want to be here pushing this mower. But you wonder, who's really mowing here? Well, what's really going on is a unity of relationship. I think when God says, come, you who are weary, take my yoke upon you, you will find rest. It's like this. That we take on this yoke, this work together with God, and are we really bearing the weight? No. But that goes back to mindset. Oh, I'm doing so much. And just our mindset creates a weariness within us, doesn't it? Because as soon as we think this is overwhelming and a burden, all of a sudden we can feel it in our bodies. But God says, I know you're weary. Come work with me and you'll have rest. But we have to understand what he means by that. That we can join him in his work and he will guide us along the path. And we look at our world and all of the unrest. How do you fix a broken world? I don't know how to do that. How do we fix all the social upheaval? How do you fix strained relationships? How do you fix a deteriorating physical body that when you don't get good rest, or even if you had a decent night's rest, you get out of bed and you go, oh, you have to stretch it out. Most importantly, how do you fix a spiritual drought? None of these things you can do on your own. We can't do it on our own, but we keep trying because we're individualists. I got to do it by my own power, my own strength, and God will say, go ahead, try. And he will let us try. Until we get weary, and then we say, your help. So when challenged with the things of this world, what do you do? When challenges present themselves, do you complain about it? I mean, we could probably hear a lot of complaining. Just turn on the news. The question is you can't do anything about other people's complaining. You can only do something about your own. You try to fix it your way. Or do you pray about it? You might be doing all three of these different ways at different times, but it's interesting that sometimes what we do is we pray about it and then we complain about it. Rather than trusting that God is going to work in it somehow, some way, he's going to work it out in his time. But oftentimes, God's timing is not my timing, and I become hard-hearted and say, God, you need to do it faster. And if you're not going to, then I will. Do you pray about it and trust God's providence that he will work it out? That he knows what's going on. You just have to go along with what he's telling you. Because doesn't God understand more than you do what's going on in our world and how it's going to work itself out? We try to help one another realize, and when we teach the younger ones, that this is the way the world really is. You don't want to do this. Are we willing to listen to what God says about how it's going to work out best for us? It's interesting, the Independence Day of Israel, when they're freed from Egypt, one of the things that they're thinking about is, man, my back hurts, that whip hurts, let's get out of here. We want freedom, not oppression. Who doesn't? And when they finally are freed from Egypt and they pass through the waters, Moses sings a song. And in part of this he says, in your unfailing love, you will lead the people that you have redeemed. Who redeemed them? God. Could they have gotten out from underneath the Egyptians' whip on their own? No. So they have a clear understanding that even when they were faced with a blockade of the Red Sea in front of them and not being able to get through it and thinking in their minds of impending doom and death, what does God do? He acts. And continuously, God tried to show them, do these signs that I'm with you. Trust me. And isn't that the same thing that Jesus, when he comes, says, here, I'm showing you these signs. What do many people often do? Show us another. What else are you going to do to prove yourself? There comes a point in time when he says, I'm not going to do anymore. I've done enough. It's up to you to make the change. Trust me in this. And you would think that the people would have so deep in their memory how that God has proven himself that they would be thankful. As we're coming to the conclusion of the study of the Torah, we've gone through the Exodus and they've been released from captivity. We've talked about Leviticus, where God has given them the law of how to live well with him and with one another. We get to the book of Numbers, which talks about the journey from Sinai to Moab when they finally get to the other side, looking across the Jordan, of the land that God was going to provide for them. But we see along the way that it wasn't easy. It wasn't burden-free. But we have to ask the question, why was it so hard? And in my journey with God, do I similarly make it difficult?
The book of Numbers gets overlooked, partly because it has a really boring name, which is a shame. In the Hebrew tradition, the book's name is Bamidbar, means in the wilderness. And it's an epic travelogue about Israel's journey through the desert on their way to the land promised to Abraham.
Now, this pilgrimage should only take about 2 weeks on foot.
But instead, it takes them about 40 years.
That's crazy. It's practically half of someone's life.
Yeah, it's a very long camping trip with lots of interesting stories. But let's remember, it's most helpful to back up and start with how this book is designed.
Right.
So the book is broken up into five sections. There are three wilderness locations broken up by two road trips that link all the pieces together.
The first wilderness section is Mount Sinai, right here on the map.
And then in the second section, they travel to a region called Paran.
A whole bunch of things happen here in the wilderness of Paran.
And then in this fourth section is Israel's road trip to Moab.
The book ends with a large section in the wilderness of Moab, right across the Jordan River from the Promised Land.
Now, through all of these sections, the storyline just flows like a gripping dramatic movie. Everything starts great, but then the trip goes worse and wrong, and it all ends with the final redemptive moment, the surprising act of God's grace.
So let's jump into the story. It all begins at the wilderness of Mount Sinai, and we become really familiar with this mountain.
Yeah, if you remember, Israel came here after Egypt, and they formed a covenant with God here, got the Ten Commandments here, built the tabernacle here, and they've been at this mountain for one whole year.
And now they take a census to number the people as they prepare to leave.
Right, and they're given these instructions for how to organize all those people in the camp. God's presence in the tabernacle, and then the tribe of Levi and the priests around it, and then the rest of the tribes around them. And this pattern is this visual symbol for how God's holiness is at the center of their existence as a people.
And they're told that when the cloud of God's presence moves, they're to pack up and travel with it.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant is carried by the Levites out in front, and then the tribe of Judah and on. And this order is also a symbol for how God's holy presence is their leader and guide through the wilderness.
We begin the second section of the book with enthusiasm as they leave Mount Sinai and travel up the Paran. God's with them, everything's organized. This is going to be great.
But it's not great. After just 3 days on the road, the people are complaining about their hunger and thirst, and then even Moses' brother and sisters start bad-mouthing him in front of all the people.
Not a great
around saying, we're going to get annihilated from in there. And so they start to mutiny, and they try to appoint a new leader who's going to take all the people back to Egypt. And so basically, they are refusing to go into the promised land. God honors their choice. He says that this generation is going to wander 40 years and die in the wilderness, and only their kids will get to enter the promised land.
You know, this story here gets brought up many times in the Bible by different authors.
Yeah, it always serves as a reminder that while God remains faithful to his people and his promises, he will honor their choices. He'll let them waste their whole lives if they choose to live in rebellion.
Okay, so the trip's been a disaster so far.
And it gets worse here in this fourth section as they're traveling to Moab. Even Moses has a moment of rebellion and is disqualified from entering the promised land. Then there's another rebellion among the people that results in this snake attack. And what makes all these rebellions even worse is that every step of the way, God has been providing. He's been offering forgiveness. He's been giving them food and water and this crazy stuff called manna.
Yeah, what is that stuff?
Yeah, no idea. But in spite of all this, they keep complaining. They say that they wish they had died in slavery in Egypt.
If I was God, I would just give up on these guys.
You would think. But that's what makes this story, the final section, so surprising. Israel has just arrived in Moab, and the king of Moab is freaked out that this huge group of people is traveling through his land. So he hires this pagan sorcerer named Balaam to pronounce curses on them.
This guy means business.
Yeah. So Balaam, he says, okay, I'm going to pray to the Hebrew God, and let's see what happens. And three different times, he attempts to curse them, but each time, he finds that he can utter only blessings. Most surprising is the last blessing, where he prophesies that out of Israel will rise a victorious king. And this king is somehow going to be connected to God's promise to Abraham to bless all nations through this family. So here's Israel rebelling down in the camp, totally unaware that up in the hills, God is protecting and even blessing them.
The book ends here in Moab. Israel's getting ready to go into the promised land. They count up everyone again, just like at the beginning. They're leaving the old generation behind, including Moses.
So before they leave Moses, he gives them his last words of warning and wisdom. And that speech is what the next book, Deuteronomy, is all about.
So what was interesting to you about that video and that summary of Numbers?
The complaining.
Why was that interesting, all the complaining?
It hasn't stopped since.
It hasn't stopped. Why?
We want what we want.
We want what we want when we want it. And when we don't get what we want when we want it, what do we believe then?
Not God's promises.
Say that again.
Not God's promises.
We don't trust God's promises that He will provide for us what we need when we need it. Because we want what we want when we want it. And isn't that the challenge that Adam and Eve had? Isn't that the challenge that every human has in coming to trust that God will provide even when you can't see how it's going to happen? Anything else that you saw in that was damning?
Actually, it's kind of strange, but just the name of it, when we see numbers, well, it's just going to talk about numbers, so I don't need to read that. And life, we look at that too. Oh, it looks like this on the outside, so I'm not going to deal with that. But there's so much more in Numbers that God is part of it, and God is part of our life too. We can't, as they say, judge a book by the cover, just by this one glance.
Yeah. Anything else jumps out at me? Yeah, Ron?
Was that depiction of the formation when they were camped accurate, that it was in the form of a cross?
It was kind of an equal-sided cross.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's at the center?
God.
God is to be at the center. And God's presence is always to be with the people at the center of their lives. And that's what that imagery was about. And isn't that the same for us? That God is always supposed to be at the center. We're always supposed to return back to, when I look around what's going on around me, I always have to look back to the center. We will always look back to the thing that we put our foundation on. And it's interesting that one family, Korah, and three other families of Levites who were the ones to pack up and carry stuff, they rebel against Moses and Aaron and say, why do you think you're better than us? We're the same family. Why do some people get to go into the temple and do this stuff, but all we get to do is carry it? And God says, wait a minute. even more than other people can do. Other people can't even touch it. Why are you rebelling? And what we find in the rebellion against Moses and Aaron and God is that the foundation that they were putting on is like, well, who are you to say this to me? God says, I'll take care of it. And the foundation that they were trusting in is that we're going to do it our way. All of a sudden, the ground opens up and their foundation leaves out from under them. And to think back to the time when they're in Paran and they have to go up into the Promised Land, many of them are complaining. We can't do anything about this. The people are in fortified cities. They're bigger than us. They're stronger than us. And Caleb says, no, we can do this. God's with us. In spite of what it looked like, he understood the foundational truth that in spite of what it looks like, God is going to do something amazing among us if we just trust him. And isn't that like Jesus walking on the water and Peter said, let me come and walk. None of the others are going, let me come out of the boat. But Peter is. He goes, come to me. You can do it. Even though Peter, every time he walked out of the boat, onto the water, he went down. Peter is trusting Jesus, not what he thinks he knows, how things always work. And he steps out and finds firm footing. I can't imagine how mind-blowing that is. And isn't that what we have to do, is trust God that he says to do this. We step out on faith. We do our best knowing that even if it blows up in my face, the God of heaven and earth is going to be proud that we're trusting that he's going to be there with us in it. It may be by blowing up in our faces exactly what it needed to do so that God's power can be seen in them. And then he gets the glory, and people come to see him in a more clear way. But what is it that God in Peter's way? He started looking at the winds and the waves. He took his eyes off Jesus. And every time we're not looking at Jesus, and I see this in my own life, when I look at everything around me rather than going back to what I'm promised and what is, that I'm redeemed, that I'm righteous, like Patrick had talked about 2 weeks ago, that I'm justified because of what God has done in spite of what I have done, that I'm no longer a sinner, I'm saved. And the terminology that I use every day has to support that. Do I sin? Yes. Am I a sinner in God's eyes? No. So stop saying it. Say what you are. I'm set apart. I'm part of the family of God. That is truth. But we keep going back to what was. And that's exactly what the Israelites did too. Is they forgot about their sore backs. Because all of a sudden something else was becoming sore. Their bellies were becoming sore. Their throats were becoming dry. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. Let's go back to Egypt. It was so much better there. Really? Is anybody beating you out here in the desert? No, but I had food back there. You'll have food here too. But I don't see in front of me right now, and it scares me. I get that. Trust me. I make things that aren't to be. I'm the God of heaven and earth. Stop trusting in yourself. And just like Jeff said, talked about last week about Paul saying to these churches, I'm perplexed that you would want to go back to the old way. Isn't that exactly what we're seeing here? Isn't that exactly the challenge that we have of going back to the old ways of thinking, the things that we trusted in the past that made us satisfied in life? And all it does is it creates grumbling and mumbling. And when we're grumbling and complaining, one of the things you're not doing is being thankful and worshipful. Are you? When you're murmuring and complaining, you're not thankful nor worshipful. Because how can you be worshipful and thankful when you're complaining? You can't. So then we have to say, okay, what am I putting my trust in? Why am I not thankful? Heart. I'm not getting rest, and the world's getting rest. That's as I know, it's terrible. But will you trust me to see you through? Will you trust me to get you to that land of promise. So in this murmuring, we say, life is not the way I want it. We're dissatisfied and disappointed with our expectations. We lack understanding of how God and the world works. Because we think God should do it this way, or the world should be this way. We have to accept the way the world is, grieve that it's not the way we want it to be, and accept the way it is so that we can live well in the presence of God, under His yoke. The problem is we get, like Israel, this distorted thinking. Because our rebellion magnifies the past positives and minimizes the past negatives. Isn't that what Israel did? Oh, at least we had food. But what did it take to get that food? Man, it was painful. Distorted thinking. God is not at the center of their understanding or their thinking. That's what happens when we grumble and murmur and complain. Nor is God the motive for how we engage the world. So we don't understand why it's going crazy and spilled under us. But what the world needs is people who are under the yoke of Jesus in this burden that is light, and we're being drawn close to Him and allowing Him to show us how to plow in this world well. So that people too can come and say, yeah, this life is crazy, but I can find some peace in the midst of the unrest. And that's what Paul comes to realize. Even though the churches were, he was struggling with them and wondering, why are you guys going crazy and going back to the old way when you trusted the promise of God? He says, I'm glad that some of you have now renewed your concern for me. But you know, I really didn't need that. But I'm glad you showed it. Because I've learned something. I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances come my way. I know what it is to be in need, and I can be content. I can know what it is to have plenty, and I can be content. But maybe it won't be there later. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation. Does that sound like rest to you? Does that sound like peace to you? In the midst of the storms of life, the challenges of our physical health, the challenges of our spiritual droughts, that we can know that God will feed us who are hungry. He will give us drink for those who are thirsty. It says, come to me, all of you who hunger and thirst, and I will satisfy you. And that all goes back to my attitude. No one else. So does your character align more with Korah, who resisted God and said God needed to do it his way in his time, or more like Caleb, who trusted that even though I'm not sure how we're going to defeat those people in those fortified lands, I'm going to trust the promise of God that he's going to see me into the land. We're going to be victorious because the God of heaven and earth is on our side. One of the things we cannot do is make it simplistic, because it's not. It's hard. It's hard to always go back to the center of trusting in God, that He is the center of my being, and push away the concerns of today for the promise that He gives us for today and into tomorrow. And in that, place ourselves on a firm foundation, like Caleb's. Not a poor foundation, like Korah. So it's laid before you in this week. Think about that. How is the unrest that I feel more about me taking my eyes off God, who should be the center of my thoughts and my hopes and my dreams, and I'm focusing more on my hope? My dreams. That this God will see you through all these challenges in His way, in His time. He has promised to do that because He loves you more than anything else. And it's proven by His Son hanging on a tree, raised from death, and living in glory. And He calls us to focus on that promise that you too will be in His presence. Let's stand and give God praise.